Shank Bagley. Shank Bagley. Shank Bagley. Hello and welcome to Shat Baggily, an old Lincolnshire adjective to describe absolutely anything loose and disorderly, which sums up this Lincolnshire lass quite nicely. My name is Katie Johnson, and this week my guests include a food historian and the co-owner of the most incredible cast iron pans designed and made here in the UK. First though, as always, because we're on series 2, episode 9, here are a few things with the same number. Width in inches of a cricket wicket. Milligrams of rat droppings permitted in a kilo of wheat by the US Food and Drug Administration. And the number of letters in strengths, which is the longest word in the English language with only one vowel. So I hope you've had a good week. We managed to get away for a few days to wonderful Venice. What a place. They say if nothing is done to help the structures with all the rising water and what have you, Venice has only another 80 years left. I feel sure they'll step in. And if you've never been, it's one of those that, oh, I'd fully recommend. And if you have, isn't it incredible? Slight incident on the way out, though. We went to stay with our friends who we were going with. I went up the night before, as it was an early flight and they live closer to the airport than we do. So navy linen trousers, thought, right, I shall fly in those, wear them the night before, comfy elastic waistband, all that. Friend says, just as leaving, what's that on the bottom of your leg? And I don't know what it was. It just is as if I'd put it in bleach. All the colour had gone right at the bottom all across. So I don't know whether it's fortunately or not, but Glyn had a black felt tip pen on him, as you do. So fill that in. Only to be stopped at the airport where they swabbed the area. You can imagine it was a little bit stressful. A bra went through fine, the underwire. Oh yeah, it was the leg. Anyway, let me through. Although we all sort of looked at each other and said, did they say what it was after they swabbed? Might have helped identify. Anyway, they didn't, and everything was okay. Fabulous time, little hot around the edges, but so inspired than I was with all that incredible food and the people. I've come home and I'm now learning Italian. Prego. That's it for now. Time for my first guest, and it was a trip to see Sue Curry from Netherton Foundry, a family-owned business in South Shropshire who design and make the most incredible iron and copper cookware. Glyn and I have known Sue and Neil for what must be 10 years, but I couldn't remember exactly when Netherton's story began.
We sold the first Netherton products into the first stockist, which was Timmis Hardware in Bewdley, in August 2011.
Cool. So, yes. And in that time, 12 years, the last 5 or 6 years, it's just gone sky high.
Stratospheric. Mm. Yeah, it's been amazing. The first few years were blood, sweat, tears. You know, why am I doing this? Shall I bang my head against a brick wall? And then all that effort paid off, and the support of people like yourselves, all the chefs, all the food writers, suddenly it's like those bands that play all the working men's clubs and then everybody describes them as an overnight success. And people say, oh, we see you everywhere.
When it all started, was it just you and Neil, your hubby? Was it just the two of you?
It was, yeah. So he was doing the designing. He was working out how we were going to make things. I was loading up my battered old Berlingo and driving the length and breadth of the country, bashing on people's doors saying, would you like to stock this British-made product? Mm.
Yeah. But do you remember the point of when you decided that this is what we're going to do? Because you'd both had careers, hadn't you, doing other things, and all of a sudden it's, we're going to do this, Sue. We're going to do this, Neil. That's it. Netherton Foundry was born.
Neil has been a designer all his life, did product design at university more years ago than perhaps either of us would care to mention. And he'd been designing product that was being made out in the Far East for brand names that you would know. So making things like kettles, toasters, fryers. And the financial crash in 2008 had a serious impact on those kind of people. And they just were interested in the bottom line. So the quality of the products was being reduced and reduced and reduced, so you could knock another 5 cents off the price. Mm. They were coming halfway around the world. They were being designed with built-in obsolescence. And we just thought, no, this is not what we're about. This is not what we believe in. Can we do something that is more sustainable, more in tune with our own personal beliefs? And that's what where Netherton came from.
Everything you use, is it fair to say, is sourced in Britain as well?
It is, yeah. Absolutely everything we source. We don't import anything. And in fact, the oak for the handles comes from an estate just down the road.
And how many people have you got working for you now then?
There's 12 of us now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And 2 people working off-site as well.
I'm sitting here and I'm surrounded by, because this is your little display area. This is where people come and they visit and they see pans. And I've already spotted there are a couple of new designs for this year, which is wonderful. You're always evolving. And I know we're going to be using a couple of them later in the year, which is good news. I'm looking at the pans, obviously designed by Neil. But where does the process start, Sue? Because there's cast iron and there's the, when you say hand spun, what's that mean?
Right. The whole process generally starts with Neil sitting at home with a piece of paper and a pencil. None of this is designed on CAD or anything like that. It's really old school. And he'll come up with the idea. From there, we will get a metal tool made. It's the former. So if you imagine the shape of a frying pan, but solid. So you've got a solid block of metal that is the shape of a frying pan. That then sits on a machine that looks a bit like a wood lathe for those people who understand these things. Mm-hmm. And a flat disc of metal is backed up against it. The spindle turns and one of our spinners will push that metal around that solid shape. Right. So it is literally made by hand. It's done cold. It was probably a dying art, but we're reviving it. We're nurturing it. We've got younger members of staff getting more and more proficient at it.
So you're not only providing a British-made product, but also bringing back a skill that we could have possibly lost.
I think so, yes. Oh. That's our intention, yeah.
The wooden handles, so it's all oak, is it?
Yes, all of it's oak, all of it's British oak. That's very amazing. Particular.
And the rivets, what's the story with the rivets, Sue?
There are 2 types of rivets. There's the metal rivets, which hold the handles on. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to cross my fingers, touch wood, although I shouldn't need to. The handles are riveted on, which means they stay on.
Okay.
In all the years we've been making pans, we have never heard of one where the handles come off.
Wow.
So, and those metal rivets are made in Ashby de la Zouche, I think.
Oh, in Leicestershire.
And the brass rivets are also British made. So even the rivets that hold everything together are made in this country. Things you don't expect, things you don't think about. Mm.
So how long would a pan take to make, Sue, from start to finish?
Oh, now that's a hard one. If you go onto our website, you can actually see videos of all the stages and all the processes of making one. Mm. There are all sorts of activities going on simultaneously that bring the thing together.
Mm. So not a fair question. Interested about the seasoning, because that's the important thing when it comes to the upkeep of your pans. It's how to keep them, isn't it? Handy tip, Sue, what have you got for us? Because I'm guessing as well, induction is different to electric hob, also gas. What can we do to keep our pans good?
Okay, well, they will work on induction. They'll work on absolutely everything. Keep them dry. That's the principal thing, because iron and water equals rust. Mm-hmm. So keep them dry. They've been seasoned, so you can use them straight away. We recommend that you just wash them in hot water. not soap. That said, if you've cooked the world's smelliest curry with 20 cloves of garlic, a little bit of washing up liquid occasionally won't do them any harm at all. Mm. And I find the best way to get them dry is put them back on the hob on a very low heat, just for a minute or so. Oh. It dries them off completely. Mm. Plus you don't get any grubby tea towels, which is a bonus, isn't it? Bonus. Absolutely. So that's what we would say. You could spend hours on the internet looking at how to season cast iron pans and spun iron pans and any other kind of pans, and you kind of lose the will to live after a while. A lot of those recommend you wipe it with oil after you've used it. Please don't. The cold oil starts to interact with the hard seasoned oil that's been through the oven that gives us this black finish, and you get bubbles, and eventually your seasoning will lift off. So please don't. There is another good reason not to put oil on your pans. Can you imagine all that dust in the atmosphere, no matter how clean your house is, settling on that oily pan? Mm. And next time you come to use it, what have you got? You've not just got an oily pan, you've got a dusty oily pan. Mm. Yuck. Mm.
Could we maybe do it with flax oil, or once it's done, that's it?
We use flax oil to season them with. If you need to re-season them, and every pan comes with instructions on how to do that, when you need to do it, plus we're always on the here on the phone to help, we recommend flax oil for re-seasoning at home. It gives the best possible finish. There are alternatives. Just don't ever use olive oil. Right. It just goes gooey. Mm. Not good.
Not good. You do a lot of exporting to America and China. And you sell what to China, Sue?
We have sold woks to China. Yeah, I know. It doesn't sound very credible, but yes, we have sold woks to China. So all that conversation we had earlier about not bringing stuff halfway around the world from China, a bit hypocritical because we're sending it the other way. But we also export to, as you said, to America, to Canada, to France, to Germany, Norway, Holland. So, yeah.
You do know the woks to China is just the same as coals to Newcastle and sand to the Saudis. Yeah. But is it right you have to do a certificate as well to say, because people worry that you might be selling on something?
Yes, we do. When we sell over to China, you have to have a certificate of origin to to actually say, yes, we made it.
Yeah. Moving on to what goes out to America, to Canada, to Holland, what is it they're buying, Sue?
All sorts. Principally, they're buying the frying pans, the prospector pans, the new chef's pans, but also a lot of the bakeware as well. That is very, very popular. Our stockist in Norway is a little bakery.
Oh, lovely.
So she's selling beautiful bread and the means of making it yourself. Bit of everything all over the place.
Our very own Val from Bake Off has contributed something as well to the organisation. Val created what, Sue?
Val created a baking sheet. She came to see us at Ludlow Food Festival. It was certainly before COVID. She marched across the field in a very headmistressy way, and we did worry about what we'd done wrong. But she turned up on the stand and just said, "You are just the people I need." And her and Neil got a piece of scrap of paper and designed a baking sheet that doesn't go boing when it gets warm in the oven. And we, because it's Val's design, we wanted to pay her a commission. And she said, "No, please make a donation to Multiple Sclerosis Society for everyone you sell." And we're still doing that now.
Amazing.
I will take this opportunity to tell you about another charity initiative we've started. We have managed to buy some iron from a steelworks in Zaporizhia in Ukraine. It's not metal that would have gone to the war effort. They were supplying a car plant in Russia. So, of course, they're not doing that anymore. We are not going to keep the Ukrainian economy going, but we're making our contribution. We bought the steel. We brought it over here. We've spun it into Prospector pans. Each one made from Ukrainian steel is stamped UKR, has a blue and yellow ribbon attached, and every one we sell, we donate £10 to UNICEF for their work with the children in Ukraine.
Oh, wonderful. I know you've done a lot with Ukraine since the war. I did mention earlier a lot of new things come up and you're always on trend. Is there something that, because it's always changing, Sue, pans are pans, they always stay the same, but there's always that thing that chefs say, have you got, could you do this? And that's always going. What's the current one at the moment?
Fire cooking is huge. The big thing, isn't it? It does scare me, all these chefs who've got fire inside their restaurants. I mean, I just cannot imagine their insurance. But so things for cooking over fire are incredibly popular, whether you're cooking indoors or out. Our very traditional tin-lined copper is also popular amongst... It's very popular in America, and it's very popular with chefs. We have just sent some copper Prospector pans down to Thomas Parry in London for his new restaurant Mountain, and we have just we are just finalising a very special project for Gareth Ward at Innisfree, which should be delivered in the next couple of days.
Yeah, 2-star Michelin chef in Wales, phenomenal talent. The biggest name you work with, who would it be?
It's got to be Nigella, hasn't it? It's got to be. We have now known Nigella for the best part of 10 years, and she is just such an amazing support to us. We, you know, this is not paid endorsement, this is just her loving what we do. She responds to our social media. If she needs something, she'll ring us up and ask for something. I've had a cup of tea in her kitchen.
Have you?
Oh, yes. Which was fantastic. Yeah, she's just such an amazing support to us. But we have to give shout outs also to Diana Henry, who put a Prospector pan on the front of her book, From the Oven to the Table. Mm-hmm. To Nigel Slater, who has also got our pans and uses them regularly and has them photographed in The Observer and has commented again on his social media how much he loves them. We can't thank these people enough. They are absolute stars, but they take the time and trouble to support the little people.
Who would have thought when you and Neil started then that this is where you'd be at?
We still suffer a little bit from imposter syndrome.
No.
You think, you know, really? Us? People are coming to us saying, we've heard of you. No, I still can't believe it. It's a difficult one to get your head around.
Now, this person could be dead or alive. Who would you have either loved or loved to see with one of your pans?
Oh, my goodness. That is really anybody at all. Do you know what? Keith Floyd. I could see him now. You know, bless his soul. I hope he's enjoying a glass of red up there. But that would just be such fun. You know, it's nothing to do with the cooking. It's just that total joie de vivre that he brought to everything.
Yeah. Oh, Keith Floyd, what a character he was. If you've not heard of him, he was a celebrity cook, a restaurateur, and television personality who published many books, combining his love of cookery and travel. And every time you saw him, he would indeed have a glass of red wine in his hand. Thank you to Sue from Netherton Foundry and their website to watch the process in full and also to buy any of the products, including the Prospector pans made with the Ukrainian steel. Netherton-foundry.co.uk. But I'll pop their details on Shep Bagley Instagram and Facebook pages too. They really do make the most beautiful pans. I had a funny experience the other day. I'll tell you, sitting in the car in a car park early evening, waiting for Glyn. I think he'd popped into the shop or something because Harvey, the dog, was in the back seat. I stayed in the car, windows open as it was still a little warm. Anyway, sense as you do, a van pulling up to my left. Engine stopped, and I'm carrying on reading a few messages on my phone. Next thing I'm hearing is, Linda. 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 I'm thinking, well, I don't know who this Linda is. So I looked up to my left, and it's the driver of the van smiling at me, standing next to my passenger door, obviously thinking, I'm Linda. So I find myself saying, I'm not Linda. Then he says, we've got the same car and the same dog, but not what I thought he would have said, i.e. you just look like Linda. So one way of meeting people, I guess. Speaking of which, time for my next guest, and it's hello and welcome to author, food historian and presenter of the Comfortably Hungry podcast, Sam Bilton. Shack Bagley was born out of a love of old recipe books, so Sam is a kindred spirit.
Absolutely. I spend my life with my nose usually in an old recipe book, and I love nothing better than doing that. I mean, it's old recipes can be quite frustrating sometimes. The further back you go, the less instructions you get. There's no oven temperatures, for example, which I'm sure you know is it can be slightly problematic, especially when you're trying to convert them for the modern audience. But for me, it's just an absolute passion. Even if I weren't writing about it, even before I started writing about food history, I'd always loved looking at old cookery books.
It was something to do with, was it grandma gave you a handwritten recipe notebook that belonged to her great aunt? Is that how it started then, Sam?
Yeah, so my nan had, like so many people of her generation, she was 102 when she died in 2018.
Wow.
Actually, sorry, 2019, sorry. So she'd reached a grand old age, but like so many of her generation, she learned to cook through watching, but she did have a copy of Mrs. Beaton's. Now, her copy of Mrs. Beaton's was from 1894, so it obviously wasn't her copy. It was handed down to her from one of her many relatives. But inside this book was a handwritten notebook. It's very small, from her. It's actually her great aunt Emma and great aunt Emma's daughter Eliza, who was the last person to add to it, which is why I refer to it as great aunt Eliza. I haven't worked out how many greats they are away from me, but it was my grandmother's great aunt's, I assume, her cookery book and the notebook she started, and then she passed it on to Eliza. And they were both, I think, in service. I did a bit of research into them, and they'd both worked in service. So I guess the recipes that they'd written down were the ones that they particularly liked. Perhaps they were learning when they first went into service. Mm. I mean, the Christmas pudding recipe that I still use to this day when I make Christmas puddings is immense. I mean, it took hours and hours to cook this thing. It was so big. So I've had to scale it back quite considerably. So that's how it all started in terms of my interest in food history. I've always been interested in history and food, but marrying the two, and I think the journey I went on sort of investigating Aunt Eliza, or Great Aunt Eliza, as I refer to her, and her history as much as you can, obviously just using the archives. Mm. But that's how it all began.
So did you find, when you said they were in service, which part of the country were they in service? Did you find that out?
Yeah, so my family are from Essex, North Essex, so near Saffron Walden. Mm. But Eliza and Emma, well, actually Emma, great aunt Emma, seems to have worked in Suffolk and then kept going north. So when I say kept going north, she didn't go that far north. She never made it as far as Lincolnshire, but she did get to, she got to Norfolk. And Eliza certainly stayed in Norfolk, her daughter, and she lived near Cromer. Yeah, she eventually married a coachman called Charles Dennis. And we actually found her house when we went to visit.
Lovely.
Gosh, this is back in the COVID days when we were suddenly allowed out. My husband and I went on a tour of Norfolk trying to find great aunt Eliza. We never found Eliza's grave, but we found her cottage that she lived in. She's still standing, which was great. Quite surreal. But it was lovely.
Do you ever think then perhaps you're born in the wrong era, Sam?
Oh, I don't know. Perhaps. I know I get asked a lot, what is your favourite era? And I think it depends what I'm making and what I'm working on at the time. I'm going to say no, because I don't know. I'm not sure that I would have wanted to whisk egg whites for 8 hours or do all the long-winded processes that you read about in books like Eliza Acton, where they're saying you have to pound the sugar. Mm. And I know, sort of going, I mean, I know it's summer at the moment, but if you go back to Christmas puddings, when you read Elizabeth David's take on Christmas puddings, she sort of says that people have this nostalgic view about how food was prepared in the past, but she said they don't take into account that you had to grate the sugar, you had to grate the breadcrumbs, stone the raisins. Can you imagine now if you went to the supermarket and bought raisins and you had to take the pips out?
Yeah.
I mean, people just wouldn't do it, would they? No. And she actually had first-hand experience of this, because when she lived in Greece, the locals asked her to prepare a traditional Christmas pudding, and she had to do all of this from scratch. Oh, she had no, I mean, she wouldn't have had a food processor anyway, but she literally had to stone the raisins, she had to grate the bread. She had a limited kitchen. And she said it was horrific. And she had to cook it over an open, in a boiling pan of water, over an open fire. And she said, never again. I think she says in the book that she didn't eat Christmas pudding for years after that, because she was scarred for life. So I think, from my perspective, as much as I love old recipes, I do love the fact, I'm not what I would call a culinary archaeologist. I do occasionally try, I do try to stick as faithfully as I can to the recipe, but if I see that there's a shortcut to be made, I take the modern shortcut, I'm afraid. So, yeah.
Is there such a thing as a culinary archaeologist?
Yeah, I think, I don't know whether they're called culinary archaeologists, but there are people out there that will replicate. So if you go to Hampton Court, for example, the kitchen's there, the guys there will be, and the ladies, will be replicating as far as they possibly can the recipes from sort of that, the 16th century, in the manner that they were cooked originally. And Ivan Day, as the food historian, has done a lot of this himself. He's got this wonderful kitchen up in Cumbria, and he's got like proper spits for roasting meat. And as he says, there's nothing quite like a properly spit roasted meat.
Mm.
Because it's not a bit, it takes hours, because obviously it's quite a slow process.
Mm.
So it's, I think when you look at it from that perspective, there are people out there that will do that. But while I say I do try to stick to the flavours, I don't grate breadcrumbs with my hand. I'm using my trusty KitchenAid for that, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Some would say you've got a life, Sam.
Yeah, well, indeed. But I do think it's important to preserve the flavours. So, I mean, sometimes it's not always possible. You know, there's, when you look at sort of Roman cookery, for example, there's a lot of things that they use that we don't have access to anymore, because either they've died out or we're frankly just not entirely sure what they are. So we're sort of guessing. But I do try to stay as faithful as I can to the flavour of the dish.
Interesting when you think, though, because you would think there's not that many new rules with food. For all in the history, food's food, how you prepare it. Yes, there's slightly different ways of doing it, but there's no, you don't reinvent the wheel. But just thinking about the methods, of course, huge at the moment is cooking on fire. So we've kind of gone back, haven't we? We've sort of gone back and starting again in some respects.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's the wonderful thing about food, is that it is absolutely timeless. So even culinary tastes, which change. So I know, obviously, nowadays we can get things like pre-prepared gelatin, so we don't have to boil down animal hooves for hours on end to make aspic. I'm still waiting for aspic to make a comeback. I'm not sure that will ever make a comeback. But a better example would be almond milk. You know, people think of this being quite, I think some people who aren't involved in the culinary world perhaps think of this being quite a new fangled thing. But actually, almond milk was king in the medieval era, because we were very strict, had a very strict religious diet where we didn't eat meat or dairy on certain days of the week. So, and particularly during periods of Lent and Advent, where, you know, if you wanted milk, you had to rely on almond milk. Plus also we didn't have fridges, so dairy milk didn't keep very well, whereas I suspect almond milk would keep better.
Mm.
I've never tried keeping it out of the fridge for any length of time myself, but I would imagine it's, bacterially speaking, and I'm not a bacteriologist, but I imagine it's probably a bit safer to keep at ambient temperature than dairy products.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think food is timeless in that respect.
talking about no fridges, another example of it would be, I guess, is that fermentation and vinegars. Everyone says, oh, this is wonderful. It's the in-trend thing. But again, we can take fermentation and vinegars way back in time.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, because we didn't have things like baking powder is, in my world, that's a new invention. I mean, it was invented in the 19th century in its pure sense, like you could go and buy baking powder. I mean, people were using potash prior to commercial baking powder being produced. But it's before that, if you wanted a cake to rise, you either had to beat those egg whites for an awfully long time, or you use yeast. And they would have used, perhaps, if it wasn't ale barm, which was the common yeast to use, they would have used sourdough starters, so for a form of fermentation. And again, vinegars were hugely a lot of important, because if you look at a lot of the sauces from the medieval era, there's that sort of almost sweet sour element where they used verju a lot of the time, which is essentially similar to vinegar, certainly. And they were preservatives as well. So they're, you know, your vinegars and your salt, a lot of salted foods, smoked foods, all these things that, you know, we think of now as sort of coming back into being, you should say, quite in vogue, were methods and ingredients that we use widely in the past.
Sourdough starter, another one. Huge. People making their own. But again, as you say, going back in time. With your historian hat on, then your food historian, what's been the greatest thing, in your opinion, that the culinary world has been given? A lot of people would say sugar. No. Something that we've been given over those years that has been of benefit. And I think maybe we wouldn't have been quite the same without it. Is that a bit hard?
It is a bit hard. I mean, sugar for sure, but not for for positive reasons, unfortunately. Gosh, what was the... Well, I would always gravitate towards spice, because I love spice. I love spicy foods. And I've written two books centred around spices, so I'm slightly biased. But I think certainly, you know, we get a bad rap in this country for having very bland food. And actually, if you look through the history books, our food was far from bland. It just all sort of went a bit wrong in the sort of mid-20th century due to world wars and, well, early 20th to mid-20th century with world wars and stuff. But yeah, I don't know. That's a tricky one. That's really is a tricky one. I say sugar would be probably, I would say, would be up there, but not for good reasons, for bad reasons. I'm sure lots will come back to me later. Yeah. But
maybe not at 2:30 in the morning, though, Sam. If it does, I apologise, and please don't ring me.
No, I won't ring you at that time in the morning. I suppose refrigeration.
Yes.
Refrigeration, I think, was probably a bit of a eureka moment. Once we worked out how to make ice cream a long time ago, but actually being able to keep food cold, I think that would have been a big thing. That's quite, again, relatively speaking, in my world, that's a newish invention. But I think refrigeration helps some. I mean, we can't really conceive today of not having stuff stored in a fridge. No. And yet my grandmother had a larder. Mm-hmm. Her house was perpetually like a fridge, but she had a larder, which did a pretty good job, actually. I don't know from, let's say, a microbiological point of view, but in terms of keeping stuff pretty decently cold, because it was on it, as they always are, on an outside wall. Yeah. But yeah, I think having a fridge is, or refrigeration is probably a major development in the food terms.
I came across you with your book, Saffron, was the history of saffron, which is a phenomenal little thing. And really, when you look at it, you don't think UK, but it was the UK.
Yeah, it was. That's the surprising thing. When I say to people, they're sort of like, why saffron? And why is it English or British saffron? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, because it was at one stage, it was a really important crop in this country. I believe in Norfolk, they grew so much that they were exporting it. It was that important. We're talking several hundred years ago now. It was probably at its height between the 15th and early 18th centuries, depending which part of the country you go to. But particularly around Essex and Norfolk and Cambridgeshire and Suffolk, East Anglia, basically. That was the primary area, if you like. Although it was, I have to say, it was grown all over the country, as far west as Cornwall. Even today, it's grown as far north as Cheshire.
Yes.
So it's a state, and it's an important, it was, historically speaking, an important crop. It's very much an artisan, call it an artisan product, but it's very much grown on a small scale now. Beautiful stuff if you could do get hold of English saffron.
I was down in Suffolk, and there was, you all know them, a company, I can't remember the name, but they were from down south with their saffron, and they were putting it in, testing people to have it in a little a tea. Oh, gosh, it was gorgeous, Sam. And
it was, yeah.
And it's good for us as well.
Yeah, so that was Sandling saffron. So they're out, as you say, in Suffolk. I mean, you can do this very easily at home. Put a few strands of saffron in a cup and fill with boiling water and leave it. I usually add a little bit of lemon juice. I know it was recommended, I believe, for measles. You don't have to have or have had measles to make saffron tea, but I believe it was one of those treatments for measles back in the day. But it's a lovely drink. I mean, it's a lovely spice. It's hideously expensive, but a little does go a long way.
It's dearer than gold, isn't it, per ounce or whatever?
I think it is, yeah. It's one of those, it's if you gram for gram, yes, I believe it is, but it's, you need very little of it. I have to say that and then add that I am quite generous when I use it myself because I love it. I know I've met people before when I've done demos and they're like, they put like two or three strands in sort of to colour rice, and I'm like, well, it's barely going to make a difference. And part of the reason it's not just colour, that's the other thing. There's plenty of other spices or things that you can buy that would colour your food the same colour, but it's the aroma and the flavour that you get from saffron as well that's important. And there's nothing else like it on earth.
No, absolutely beautiful. And good to know that we're still growing it in this country as well. Because that's the danger of things, isn't it? We're losing so many skills, arts, foods because of the land available. And no, it's good to know that it's still going. Where are you to in your food history then, Sam? Do you have I know you said a lot of people say, what's your favourite era? But in the scale of things, have you written everything you want to write in from zero to now? Or is there a particular area that you are yet to discover or uncover?
Well, I certainly haven't written everything I want to write. I've just finished a book earlier this year, which will be out in the autumn, and that's on chocolate. So I'm getting away from spices.
Oh, thank you for doing that, Sam. Just to say thank you on behalf of most of the ladies in the population.
So that's it's called The Philosophy of Chocolate. It's with the British Library, and they have a series of books on the philosophy of. So they've done one on coffee, on gin, on beer, and cheese, and they asked me to do one on chocolate. So that was really fun to write because it's slightly different. I'm afraid it's not a recipe book.
No,
Casey, I'm afraid
it's all right.
It's an interesting take on it because it's looking at chocolate from different perspectives, whether it be seductive chocolate or spiritual chocolate. So that was fun to write. But I certainly have got plenty of other things I'd like to write about. I'd really actually like to write a biography one day.
Okay.
So I've just got to find a suitable subject. So I'm doing a bit of research at the moment onto various culinary figures that I don't think have been given enough attention.
Oh,
well, yeah,
that's interesting. So, from this country or abroad?
From this country. So it's just because it's easier to get the access to the materials.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I would like to do. But it's, yeah, we'll watch this space, as they say.
Well, who's the lady? Now, I've got to get it right. That was linked to Arlie Hall.
Oh, Elizabeth Raffold.
Yes. She was fascinating.
So Neil Buttery has just written a biography on her. So Neil's beat me to it. So I can't do that. But Neil Buttery, who's also a food historian, he's just written a biography on Mrs. Raffold called Before Mrs. Beaton.
Yes.
Because obviously everyone's heard of Mrs. Beaton.
Yeah.
But she was. I mean, she was writing in the mid 18th century, and she had a phenomenal career and short. I mean, she died like so many people did in those days. I think she was dead by the time she was 47, something like that. It's but a very action-packed or full-packed life. So.
Yeah, and still at Arlie Hall to this day, is it the Eccles cake is her recipe?
It is the Eccles cake. It's not called the Eccles cake in the book. It's got it's something like a sweet patty. It's got a very peculiar name, but it's an Eccles cake. Yeah. If you read the recipe, any cook would recognise it as an Eccles cake. So it's that's the thing about historical recipes. Invariably, you read them, and when you read them, you go, well, hang on, that's like a hollandaise sauce, but it's not called a hollandaise sauce. Mm. It's called something completely different. Yeah. And that is the case with the Eccles cake that Elizabeth Raffold wrote down. So it's, a great book to read. I've read it, and it's a fabulous read, and say she had a fascinating life.
She did. It's interesting, isn't it, when you look back in history, when you look now, majority of our chefs and food writers are men. But when you look in the olden days, there's only a handful of fellas, aren't there? They are mostly women.
I think it depends on the style of cookery. So you get, I think people like Raffald tended to be what we would call cooks. So I think Delia Smith always says that she's a cook, not a chef. Mm. Certainly Raffald, Hannah Glass, Eliza Acton would all have put themselves in that, although they were working, cooking for a living, they would have put themselves in the realm of cooks rather than chefs. But then you get on the other extreme, you get people like Robert May and Charles Carter, and then you come forward into the 19th century, people like Alexis Soyer and Francatelli. They were chefs. They would not want to be called cooks because they were chefs. Mm. And I think, I'm guessing it's probably not dissimilar today, perhaps. Maybe I'm going to get shot down in flames for saying this, but I think female food writers are perhaps, with a few exceptions, obviously people like Angela Hartnett are chefs, and they're good and right, and mm-hmm. very good chefs at that. But generally, I think female food writers are viewed as cooks, and I suspect that chefs are very much viewed as being quite a male-dominated profession.
Oh, look forward to that then. I'm intrigued. I won't put you on the spot and ask who it was, because obviously you're still deciding which one to go for. But that sounds fascinating. So the book on chocolate's out in the autumn. The yes. British Library, I find that must be wonderful. The amount of material you must have access to must be amazing.
British Library, I mean, if you're a registered reader, which anyone can be, is a fabulous resource. And their manuscript section is amazing. I get very excited when I have to go there with the rare book section.
Do you have to wear gloves?
No, you don't have to wear gloves. And I was really disappointed. I even went with gloves, and they were like, no, you don't know. They don't like you to wear gloves because you can't feel. You need the dexterity. You do have to make sure you have clean hands, obviously. But it's very exciting when you get to go to the rare books or the manuscript section, because that's where the super interesting stuff is.
Yeah. But no gloves needed. I do apologise for Harvey's appearance midway. It was the postman. Huge thanks to Sam Bilton, and look forward to The Philosophy of Chocolate. And the one we mentioned was Sam's History of British Saffron, which is out now. Arlie Hall, with the Elizabeth Raffald's Eccles Cakes, is a stately home in Cheshire and one of the filming locations for the huge television show Peaky Blinders. Also, chocolate fact for you, any excuse. According to an experiment 15 years ago, chocolate teapots can work as long as the chocolate is more than 1 centimetre thick. Ah, the things you learn. I did find this week, The Business of Being a Housewife, a manual to promote household efficiency and economy, compiled by Jean Prescott Adams, a domestic science director from America. And it was under the points on selecting dishes for dinner that made me smile. I quote, "With a meat or fish dish, serve one underground vegetable." I know what she meant, but now all I have a picture in my mind is of a potato wearing a trench coat, glasses and a false moustache. And Tuda, also to Israel, as Shat Bagley made the listening charts there for the very first time last week. I do hope I've pronounced that correctly, especially as my brain at the moment has Grazia and Ciao going on. So that's it for another week. Thank you for listening, and see you next time. Arrivederci! No, I'm not Linda.